Welcome back to Discourse, the weekly occult and esoteric podcast hosted by myself, Abimon the Great, and Dr. Anna Stone. It's spooky season, and this week we're discussing the rite of exorcism, detailing its role in Mesopotamia, its preservation in the Catholic Church, and the ritual technology behind it. So breathe in, young magus, and let the work begin. Okay, welcome back to Discourse with myself, Abimon the Great, joined as always by Dr. Anna Stone.
Hello.
Hey, so it's spooky season, so we're doing a little bit of a spookier episode this week. We're going to be going over exorcism. You're wearing a pretty nice getup for
this. It's a costume.
Yeah, and I'm wearing exorcism robes. These weren't a part of Halloween. I've just had them.
They're not.
Yeah. So you got them for me.
I did.
A while ago. But yeah, so exorcism, we're going to be going over basically, exorcism is famous, you know, from the movies and the Catholic Church, but it's something that's a large part of ceremonial magic, ritual magic, alternative healing, right? So you'll see if you go to New Age people, Reiki healers, a lot of times they'll deal with exorcisms too. I don't know how effective it is, though. I've never been to one of them for an exorcism. But this tradition actually goes back a long ways, very, very far. And it's very closely intertwined with the occult. So the entire realm of demon summoning and ceremonial magic in medieval and Renaissance Europe was developed by people within the church that were inverting the exorcism rites, and instead of banishing the demons, they were like, oh, well, I'm gonna just make them do work for me, right?
Correct. Yeah. Like, it's the idea of know your enemy to the fullest extent. So it originally was clergy that were summoning demons and working with the infernal.
Yeah.
So, to my surprise, honestly, when I found that out.
Yeah. So there's actually this like story that at the University of Paris in the Middle Ages, the boys that were studying there, they kept getting busted for summoning demons to help them with their homework.
Yeah.
Which is the most teenage boy thing ever. Like, I love that.
They had to make a rule against it
because
of how prevalent it was, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's like these 15-year-old boys in university are like, oh, my homework's stressing me out, so I'm going to summon one of these demons or work some magic in order to, you know, memorize everything for my test that's coming up.
The demon of rote learning.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I think we are going to start out with, should we start out with the Catholic rites, or?
I mean, I think everybody is familiar with the Catholic vibe of it, right? Because the exorcist.
Yeah.
That was my first exposure to demon possession, and exorcism was that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I unfortunately saw that famous scene, you know, with the crucifix when I was 6 years old at someone's birthday party, and it scared the absolute crap out of me. I was terrified of that for so long. And thought that the Catholics were the penultimate authority on it. However, we learned that that is the case now.
It is.
However,
I definitely think so. I think no matter who you are, if you ever find yourself in that situation, most likely going to go to the Catholic Church for help with that. No matter what religion you are or what you believe in, what brand of Christian. We kind of look at them as the authorities just because they're so developed in it, and they have like such a developed methodology for it. However, I was very, very surprised as I've been rooting around Mesopotamia to find that what the Catholics are doing almost to a T, the Mesopotamians were doing. So the Catholic exorcism rites are almost one-to-one the exact same as the Mesopotamian exorcism rites. And it goes back to what we were talking about with how the Mesopotamians, they were obsessed with evil spirits, right? So a lot of our ceremonial ritual magic procedures, like the magic circle, comes from the Mesopotamians, because the Mesopotamians tend to blame a lot of things on evil spirits. So they had these exorcists that were basically working magicians within the community, right? And they were like white magicians, and they were called Apisu, right?
Yes.
So these were working magicians that sometimes they would be associated with the temple or the priest class. They were definitely trained in the local religion, but they were more independent private practice people. And their entire function, the Apisu, was an incantation priest.
Okay.
Or an incantation magician. And their entire function was that they went out and they helped people privately. And so what would happen was there would be superstitions and popular beliefs in the pop culture. And then these Apisu, the religion would kind of have to absorb those popular beliefs and then start dealing with them. Because so if the commoners thought that this type of evil spirit existed and it wasn't part of the religion, then the priests would have to like kind of, okay, well, they believe that this thing exists, and then the Apisu would have to go and address it for them. And so it was like this constant like evolving spiritual hierarchy and spiritual class, and the Apisu was trained in kind of the popular culture. He was also trained with the priests, and a lot of times he did it for money. So a lot of times the people that were getting help from it were the wealthier from this guy were the wealthier ones, because they had to pay him. Yeah.
Well, that tracks.
Yeah.
That tracks. But it makes sense that they would be incorporating those beliefs, because as we know now, reality or perception is our reality. So if we perceive that something is caused by a certain thing, that's our reality. So they would have to.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. So I think the battle, I guess the big thing is like, this is where we first see like the concept of witches start getting developed too on the historical record. Mm-hmm. And it's very much to a T how we think of witches. They were this kind of
hag.
Yes. So a lot of times they didn't know who the witch was, right? It was just if somebody fell ill and there was like weird stuff going on, they're like, oh, they're suffering from a witch, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what witch? Well, we don't know. And so they've got to go find one.
Yeah.
You know, where's the witch? There were, you know, women, and, you know, the witches were always women.
Of course.
There were women that lived in, you know, rural communities surrounding the cities that practiced folk magic. And then they kind of like started assuming this role of a witch. And the witches were the mortal enemy of the Apisu, right? The Apisu was functioning. The Apisu had two enemies, demons and witches. And that was their function in the society. Yeah.
I'm right here.
Yeah.
this is again tracks. This is repeated over time, over and over again throughout our history. So this doesn't surprise me in the least, especially the part about we don't know who. So let's find the eccentric older lady who's single.
Old medicine lady living out in the...
with her cats.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. With her cats.
You know, that's what it is. You know,
isn't that where familiar cats come from? Yeah.
Yeah, the familiar aspect of witchcraft, where you have the black cat or... Yeah.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it started in Egypt with the cats, but it's always women. We're always to blame for all the horrible things that happened to everybody, I guess. So what happened? So Mesopotamia and the Apisu, what next?
Yeah, so the Apisu themselves, the exorcists, this is something that I thought was super interesting, that they were basically etiologists. Like most of their role was etiology. They had to discern whether something came from supernatural causes, medical causes, that kind of thing, which is something that we know the Catholic Church maintains, like they're very strict about it, right? Like this practice is really built into modern Catholic exorcism, where basically the church has to be like, you know, send the person to a physician, yes, send the person to a psychiatrist, that kind of stuff. They have to rule out all the things. So this is like really a huge role of the exorcist. The exorcist has to be able to, you know enough about in Mesopotamian society, know enough about medicine, about psychological distress, anxiety, that kind of thing.
Natural disasters also, yeah, right? How they play out.
Yeah. And then he would be the one that would decide, okay, like you are suffering from a witch or you are suffering from a demon. And there were two modes of possession in Mesopotamia.
Okay.
It was possession through sin or possession from a witch. So one is your fault and one is not your fault.
Interesting.
Yeah. So if you weren't, if you were sinless and you were pious, right? If you're a pious, sinless person or whatever, and you were possessed, then the exorcist would come to the conclusion, well, there's a witch. There's a witch that you're suffering from.
Is the witch in the room with us?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes no sense. But yeah, I mean, there's no one without sin, according, right? Mm-hmm. So that's silly. But it's always, you said again, wealthy people too. So it's people that are with the means to get rid of their enemies this way. I'm sure it was used as a tool.
Yeah, I'm sure it happened. I mean, it's not recorded, or at least not that I could find. But yeah, I didn't really see much about like witch burning there, though it was talking, like you don't see any like records of people being persecuted. But we can assume it's happening because there are records of the procedures of dealing with a witch, mm-hmm, right? What to do, how to kill a witch, right? And it's burning. You burn the witch. Like you have to burn the witch, right? Because there's something, if you find the witch and you kill the witch, they have the opportunity to become a demon if you just kill
slay them.
Yeah, if you just slay them. Then they just go to the spirit side and that could make them even more dangerous. Hmm. So you have to burn their bodies in order to be done with them.
On the other side, they can be everywhere and nowhere at the same time.
Yeah.
And they can rally the troops, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
come get you, bring their legion with you. So with them, I guess that makes sense, but no, it doesn't. You know, this is, again, this repeated itself fairly recently in our own history, so.
What, you mean in puritanical America? Oh, yeah.
Yes, you know, like, I'm vibing, I'm almost the Puritan vibe, but instead I put the headphones
on. You had a Puritan outfit on earlier. I thought that looked great. I loved that outfit. That was an awesome outfit.
It's the same dress. Like, okay. No.
No, there was the one with the, like,
oh, the white collar. Yeah. The white collar. That's like this dress with the white collar. That's all.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, okay. So this is not based in religion, though. Is it necessarily?
What?
Was this exorcism based on the religion, like the Catholic Church is now?
The religions of Mesopotamia, there was this kind of like Egypt.
Okay.
Is a large, over-encompassing mythology, but largely localized. Every city has their own temple, their own priests, and it has a huge civic and cultural function. What I'm specifically talking about, what I was reading about and studying when researching for this, was particularly in Babylon. Okay. So, and Babylon would be descendant of the Sumerians. They took a lot of their cues from the Sumerians. So, but
okay. And then, so they started it there with exorcism. So that's been going on since then. So starting then, that's the first recorded history we have of it, correct?
Of exorcism. And it was what I thought was pretty cool about it was like these were functioning magicians, basically. They were ritual incantation magicians. And so they had these rituals that they were using where they would sprinkle water on, like, consecrated holy water on the afflicted.
Appropriation much? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds familiar, vaguely.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
I love it. And during these rituals, they're doing these invocations of their gods and their epithets, right?
So okay.
They're invoking Marduk and Ea and all the Mesopotamian gods using their epithets and their casting with every epithet, they're exercising, casting out while making these, you know.
Didn't they use figures too?
Yes. So this is something that you would do. So water was a huge part of these rituals. And there were two different types of water, right? So you've got dirty water, which is water from Tiamat. And that is ocean water, basically water that you can't drink, right? And then you've got clean water, which is water from Apsu. And Apsu is the water of the heavens that they see the sun coming out of, the moon going into. And that comes from the Tigris and Euphrates, comes from springs, it comes from wells. It's water that you can drink, right?
Okay.
So this was holy water, specifically the water from the Euphrates, though. They really liked the water from the Euphrates for some reason. But when you wanted to kind of like bind the demon or bind the witch, you would create a image or a figure, like kind of like a voodoo doll or whatever, and you would put it in the water and wash your hands over it with the water. But once the image was in there and you had washed the impurity of the curse or the demon off of you onto the image, that water was tainted. It was dirty water. Like, you couldn't touch it, right? And that kind of gave me a little bit of a flashback to something that I've been doing in my rituals, because I use images in my magic. And when I'm doing these petitions, I've been putting it into the water, right? The image, I put it into the water and just like kind of hit me. I was like, am I, you know,
yes.
Am I basically cursing my my image or something?
Or are you purifying it?
Purifying it. That was my thought process behind putting the images in the water, you know, when I was done with them.
Right.
Right.
Because your image that you create for your ritual is pure until it's finished being drawn. And as soon as it's finished being drawn, it now embodies all of your traits. And so, you know, if you have things that aren't pure about you, whatever that means, then theoretically speaking, that image would have it too. So you're consecrating or you're washing it away by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
No? That's what I would think. Purifying it.
From
its worldly attributes now.
Yeah, I was thinking that I was purifying it. Because one of the things that I've understood in alchemy is that, you know, water is fire, right? So whenever you soak something in water, or you using clean water, holy water, that kind of thing, you're actually setting it aflame.
Sure. Right? Yeah, yeah, you're purifying it. You're correct. Yeah, I didn't know it was fire, but...
Yeah,
I guess has the element of fire in it.
It's the Porto Alchemica. It's that you clean with fire and you burn with water, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the opposites.
Yeah.
It's a upside down day. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So, yeah. So they did that, and did they then bury it? What did they do with it afterwards? What the doll or the image that they created or the little clay,
it's usually
a clay figure, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah, they do clay figures or images, but you're seeing this area is known for image magic, right? Mm-hmm. So you see it go all the way up into the Arabic tradition. That's why I do image magic, because it's part of the Arabic tradition, and seeing these people, these first magicians, these first exorcists or whatever, are doing image magic. It's like, oh, like that's where that comes from. It's always been a part of this area of the world, right?
Well, I think it's interesting that it has been that exorcism and demonic possession has been going on since recorded history starting. Like, that to me is wild, because I had originally thought that this was more of a newer phenomenon, because, you know, you always hear people talk about, especially religious people talk about those back in the days, everything was so great with all of these figures around. Mm-hmm. That were holy and pure, but turns out this has been something going on far before Christianity was a thing.
Yeah, so I personally feel most of the darker stuff comes from Mesopotamia, right? When you're talking about demonology, you're talking about chaos, when you're talking infernal hierarchies,
right?
This is all, it's a very Mesopotamian flavor, right? Whereas, like, Greek has this kind of like narcissistic soap opera flavor, and then Egyptian has this kind of like weird magico religious flavor to it. You know, it's not as dark, right?
Right. It's more kind of sacred feeling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Like death is like a beautiful thing in Egypt, and
right,
you know,
the rituals they have.
But when you're talking about like demons and evil spirits and that kind of stuff, then, you know, to me that's Mesopotamian flavored, right?
Well, I always think of that because I always think, whenever I think of demons, I think of one specifically, yeah, for some reason, because of The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. So that demon. And I remember that little figurine that he digs up,
yeah,
in the beginning, and that's from Iraq. He's in Iraq.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, it checks out. And I don't know. No, maybe they knew that when they were making that movie.
They did.
Maybe, oh, they knew the Mesopotamian, yes, connection. It was just, it was really surprising to me to see how, like, how preserved the ritual is as far back, like, using the water. And it's interesting because they called the water of Apsu was the living waters, right? Mm-hmm. And the living waters is what purified the person of the evil.
Okay.
So, I mean, what is the living waters in
blood
the
of
New
Christ.
Testament? The living waters is the Holy Spirit, right?
I don't know.
So if you believe in Jesus, then he gives you the living waters, which is the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit comes into you, and that's what protects you from demons, which is like...
Never heard that.
Yeah.
Is that what baptism's for?
Well, I think this is also where baptism comes from too, right?
Yeah.
So we see it in the, like with Mandaeans, John the Baptist. I mean, this whole area is riddled with like how sacred, you know, the waters are, right? And it comes from the Tigris and Euphrates. So baptism rites, we're seeing this exorcism, it's linked to, you know, using water in order to purify people. And then this kind of like living waters thing that we see coded into Christianity. This is all just screaming that it's coming from the same place.
Well, right? It makes sense. Water, if you're people before science and soap, I would say that you see that water cleans things.
Yeah.
So if it's cleaning your dirty hands and body, why wouldn't it clean your soul also?
Yeah. So I've got this ritual right here. So they were going to the Mesopotamian incantation. So it started off with the ritual. It started off with the water was the most important element of the exorcism, right? Okay. And then it slowly evolved into the incantation being more important than the water, right?
Okay.
So it turned into the kind of psychodrama and the words and that kind of thing. So that's when the Apisu went from being this kind of exorcist into an incantation priest, and that's when he starts going into more of a white magician's role where he can perform spells and that kind of thing. But you see within the incantation, he's calling on, you know, in the name of heaven be thou exorcised, in the name of earth be thou exorcised, right? So we see right there in Solomonic magic, that's the hexagram that we're using in Solomonic magic, right? Heaven's earth right there. This is all like Hebrew coded. You have the Lord of the world, mistress of the world, the mighty warrior, the exalted messenger, the mistress of mankind, Ishtar. These are all being invoked in order to get rid of these spirits, right?
Okay.
And under these, and we're seeing all these planetary associations right here, right? So we're seeing this also making it into how we operate in ceremonial magic, right? This is exactly how the Solomonic tradition works, right?
Yes, it is.
So Bel, Lord of the world, Beltis, mistress of the world, Ninib, mighty warrior of Bel, you know? So we're seeing like that Adonai, we're seeing Mars in here, the exalted messenger of Bel, we're seeing Mercury, Hermes, the Lord of Thunder, Jupiter, Zeus, these are all being evoked here to command these evil spirits.
So it's
whatever.
Basically the same formula, just the names have changed.
Yeah.
The associations have changed because of the time and the culture.
Yeah, it's the exact same formula, which is, I think, like going through the ritual and reading the ritual and seeing it with occult eyes from the Solomonic tradition, and then also, you know, how the Catholics do it, you see the ritual nearly preserved for It's got to be 3,000, 4,000 years now.
Well, on the books, it was unchanged from the 1600s to the 1999.
The Catholic version.
Yeah. But they have borrowed it from before, and they borrowed it from Judaism, and then Judaism borrowed it from Mesopotamia, right?
Yeah, there's a huge game of telephone that's going on, but yeah, basically.
Right.
So the Jews, they got exiled to Babylon, famously, and that was when the Torah started being written down. And so that's why you see a lot of Mesopotamian influence come in with, you know, famously the story of Noah, the creation myths, that's a lot of crossover there. It's because the Jews were in Babylon before they went back. So original Judaism looked a lot different from the Judaism that we know today. It was very much a appease the gods, sacrifice the animal type of cult until that was like the first temple period. And then the Babylonian exile is when they kind of picked up a lot of the Mesopotamian traditions, made their way back to Judea. And then that's when we get the Judaism that's kind of infused with Mesopotamia.
Interesting. Yeah. Yes, because in the second temple period, that's when the first mention of Asmodeus comes up in the Book of Tobit.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does. It is, and it is filled with formulae, incantations, and demonic confrontation stories.
Really?
Yes. It talks about Josephus recounts of Eleazar, the Jewish exorcist, stories of the Jewish exorcist that started in the Second Temple period. So that's where, and so during this time also, it was done that Eleazar drew a demon out through a man's nose with a ring that Solomon gave him.
Oh.
So he put the ring in the man's nostril and pulled the demon out with the ring. And that's why the rings are so important in Solomonic magic.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard that story before. That's
in the Book of Tobit.
Okay. Yeah.
So then they got it. And then we kind of jump to 1600s, right? And that's when the Catholic Church decided we're going to codify this and we're going to make it ours. And that's what they did. And it was unchanged from 1614 under, what Pope was it? It was Pope Leo. And from 1614 to 1999, it was unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1999, there were some revisions made to it, minor, very minor revisions, but it's been the same. And I find it, so I'm going to let the cat out of the bag here. You cannot access the actual ritual process, even if you're clergy. And I know this because I tried today. I tried to obtain the actual rites of exorcism with all of the adjurations, all of the formula, all of the hand symbols, what you're supposed to do, sign of the cross. And I was met with, you're not authorized, you're not clergy. Yes, I am. No, it's classified even for clergy. Not only is it classified from clergy, it's classified by our government.
Yeah.
And I did not see that coming. And it gave me a bit of a shock, to be honest. I was sitting at my desk at work trying to look this up. My work computer is filled with a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with work. But I was so confused. So I went to the publisher who actually creates the books for the Catholic Church. And it said to email them your documents to let them know that you're authorized clergy. So I did that and I was told no. You have to be an authorized bishop or higher in the Catholic Church, and authorized as an exorcist to obtain this information. So while you can find bits and pieces of the ritual and the incantations that they say, you cannot actually find the real thing. And unless you are somebody that has been given that permission by the Vatican. So that was interesting to me. I did not, and it scared me. I will be honest, I was a bit frightened by that, because why can't other people know about it? I'm very aware of a lot of evangelical pastors they've been doing it for a while, but starting to, you know, using exorcism to alleviate possession within their congregations. I don't know how effective that is.
Yeah, so there's a few different things you can do, right? So there's the full-blown exorcism, right? Like the big one.
There's eight different ones.
Yeah, yeah. So the one that's in, there's an exorcism, right, for Lucifer himself, Satan himself.
The most difficult.
Yeah.
Like, apparently that's the most severe, difficult, and scary one.
Yeah.
And that's one you cannot access. That is definitely one of the ones you cannot get your hands on.
Should we go over it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
All right. So I managed to trick the system a bit, because while you cannot obtain it in English, it is available in Latin.
In Latin, yeah.
So I found it in Latin, and then I asked my not so great friend anymore, ChatGPT, to translate it for me, but I didn't tell it what it was translating. I just gave it section by section without letting it know what I was translating, what I wanted translated, because I already knew that it was off limits. So I got what I got up until that chapter that I tried to input in, and that's when it came up and said, I can't do this for you.
Yeah.
But it had already done it, so it didn't catch it quick enough. So part of it we have, right?
Yeah, so the book that you were working through is the Manual Exorcismo from 1619. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of the textbook for ritual exorcism in the Catholic Church for centuries, right?
Like, correct.
And it contains all the procedures that they go through. So we're going to link it in the description if you want to get your hands on it. It is in Latin. I think Latin's passable. I think you can figure out, you know.
Or you can throw it into a translator.
Or throw it into a translator.
But be careful. Do it section by section. Don't do it all at once, or it'll flag it.
So yeah, we wanted to go over the ritual proceedings, the ritual procedures, basically just for magicians because in magic, we practice exorcisms, right? So we just look like what the Catholics are doing and then what we're doing. You know, the evangelical pastors, they're dealing with more like demonic oppression, which is a much lighter exorcism, right? It's what we as magicians call banishing or purification, right?
It's when you have that presence that's not yet in you, but it's around you, right?
Yeah. So the main structure, though, for the big one, the exorcist is doing preparatory prayers, the litany of saints, invokes Christ, Virgin Mary, the apostles, the martyrs, confessors, and all these saints for assistance, right? So within preparation, there's just an invocation of basically all the Christian spirits.
This is the minor one. Yeah, this is the minor exorcism then.
No, this is the big one. The Lucifer one's the next one.
Okay.
Yeah. So after that, then they're going through a reading of the Psalms. And this is actually going through the book of Psalms. It's like people in magic like to practice it. It's a practice where you are basically reciting the book of Psalms every single day. It's supposed to just like blow the top off of you. I haven't done it yet. I do want to try it, but a lot of magicians recommend it, like if you want to like blow the roof off of your magic. But so the second part of this exorcism ritual is going to be reading Psalm 67, let God arise and let his enemies be scattered. And then it's followed by Psalm 34 and 53. And these are basically invocations of God's judgment, right? There's a lot of invocation that's going on here. And this is kind of the same as what's going on in the Mesopotamian incantations. You're getting invocations of all of God's powers and aspects. They're doing it through their polytheistic pantheon, but the exorcist in the Catholic Church is doing it through the saints, Christ, Virgin, apostles, all
so
that.
So you're kind asking, they're asking for those attributes of each one of those
yes.
individuals.
And for
to
them
to come into them, to work through them. Is that what you're saying?
Not. They're asking them for assistance, right? So it's basically the way that Catholics view it is that when you ask the apostles or the martyrs or the saints for something, they pray to God for you, right? So that's the way that, that they view it.
Okay.
That's their loophole. You
Aren't
know?
They up there with the guy?
Huh?
Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. So then after that, they go into the Gospel of John and the Nicene Creed.
Okay.
And then they go into the central formula of adoration. And this is the one that takes a long time. I'm not going to read it on the podcast, but you can look it up. The central formula of adoration. I adjure thee, every unclean spirit. Mm-hmm. And it goes on and on and on. And the exorcist is commanding the name of Jesus Christ. He's doing the signs of the cross. He's invoking the passion, the resurrection, and the ascension of Jesus Christ,
mm-hmm.
Standing over the patient, I guess you would call that. And then it does an invocation of the Holy Trinity. And so each invocation of the Holy Trinity is done three times. Each phrase is accompanied by a sign of the cross. And then it goes into the final benedictions, which is going to be your Pater Noster, your Our Father, Ave Maria, Hail Mary.
Mm.
And then they bless water, salt, and the afflicted person, okay. Right?
Yeah.
So right there, you're seeing the water again, the salt, that's the Mesopotamian flour or whatever.
Flour
that's still making it into the ritual. That's incredibly important, right?
Yes.
So
they use salt?
Yes.
Huh. Oh, I didn't know they use salt.
Well, the Mesopotamians used flour.
Oh, I know. They use flour for their circles and such, but so do you have the part about what questions you're allowed to ask the demons?
I actually didn't print that. Yeah, I didn't print that out. But basically, you're not allowed to ask the demons anything that is out of curiosity. So
fair.
You can't sit there and, you know, somebody's possessed. Anything that's going to appease
the
any kind
ego.
Of sense that you have. You can't ask the demon any of those questions. The only questions you can ask the demon has pertained to helping the afflicted. Those are the only ones. So the exorcist before going into this ritual has to have completely unshakable faith, right?
That's what they say.
Yeah. So most of the operation that the church claims, and I personally believe this is like my whole philosophy on dealing with spirits, especially the amount of spirits that I deal with, is that your best defense is unshakable faith. That is like the number one thing. Right. So the exorcist has to go in. They have to be in a state of fasting, piety, obviously sexual abstinence. Right. And they can't be walking around with any pride, any curiosity on the kind of thing. So they have to walk into.
So it's impossible.
I don't think it's impossible. I think this makes sense to me. This makes sense to me because I know when I'm at my worst. With my spirit conjurations, it's when I have, like when the spirits can get to me, it's when I'm dealing with them and I have a sense of pride or I have this sense of like insatiable curiosity, right? That's when the spirits start messing with me. So I completely understand what the church is saying in this exorcism manual about how the exorcist has to approach these demons. Because I know when I approach spirits in that state, they get to me. They mess with my head, right? They make me anxious. They make me manic, like that
kind
of thing.
Yeah, they
right?
do.
And so,
why doesn't
I don't know.
That doesn't happen for me. I do not listen to, you know me, I think all of them are full of absolute crap.
Uh-huh.
I don't care what they say. I just I tell you what they say, but I'm sitting there saying, yeah, right, the whole time, because I don't believe them. I don't believe it at all. I don't know why that is, because I have no religious faith like that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, that you can ask them, what's their name?
Yeah.
You can ask, why are they there?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the reasons for the Catholics? What do the Catholics believe are the reasons why you can be possessed? Do you know?
There were a few different things. One of them was anxiety. One was sin. One was
the glory of God.
And then the glory of God too.
What?
That one makes sense to me too. That's the book of Job. That's what that whole book is about. And the book of Job is probably, I think, the most profound book in the entire Abrahamic corpus.
Mm-hmm.
I love that book. I think the highest mysteries are contained in the book of Job.
I just think it's interesting that these rituals existed prior to Christianity.
Yeah.
How the hell do they work? How do they work? I mean, so because Catholics are Christians, right? And so if it came from elsewhere before Christianity was a thing, why would the demons that obviously existed previous to Christianity care about any of this at all? It is not calling out to anything that they're actually tied to.
Well, so it's about intention. And this is another thing that the exorcism manual talks about, is that you have to go in with pure intention. You can't have any other intention or else it's not going
to
work.
To what?
Right?
Get rid of them?
So, yeah, to help the afflicted.
Okay.
So the intention has to be there. And the thing is, it's not necessarily the words that are being said. This is something that the manual makes very clear. The exorcism manual makes very clear. It's not like if you believe that it's the words that are doing the power, that if you believe the words have the power, if you believe the relics that you're using have the power, then you're going to fail the exorcism, because
it's the practitioner.
Yes.
So again,
this is
yes.
The Catholic exorcism is ritual magic. This is
hyper aware of that.
Yeah,
I have been hyper aware of that for a very long time, and it's just interesting to see it in black and white from the church.
Yeah,
myself with my own eyes.
Yeah, like as a magician, and you're reading through that ritual, you're just like, this is
really, guys,
100% what we do.
Yeah, and 100%. Then you condemn us. You know, why is that? So there's a couple reasons why it's illegal. It's banned from people's, you can't have it, you can't get it, even if you are ordained, even if you're a pastor or clergy, it doesn't matter, you can't get it. And there's some reasons for it. And the main reason is that they don't want it to be misused for a litany of reasons, one of them being the, you know, punitive punishment for mental illness stated in there. Like, they don't want people that are mentally ill to be subjected to it.
Mm-hmm.
It is deemed a last resort by all of the bishops that authorize. It is only after extensive medical clearing and psychological clearing and ruling out any other possible cause. So they don't want it to be taken and abused. They don't want it to be widespread, because if it becomes widespread, and I don't know if you read this part, but I found this highly interesting, because we talk about this, you and I have talked about this before in a different context, but they feel that if the more people that have it, the less effective it becomes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sharing the knowledge that you're not supposed to share. Because once you share it and it becomes widespread, it is no longer effective.
Well, there's also this principle too, I guess, when you're dealing with magical self-defense, is that you don't want people to know how your wards are set up, or what your magical self-defense is, because then if somebody knows, then they know the chinks in the...
Yeah. It's also
like they know the weaknesses that they can exploit.
It's sacred knowledge, and it's only supposed to be used sparingly, etc. But yeah, because it is move in silence, the more people that know it, the more access the powers that they're trying to get rid of have to access it themselves.
Yeah.
To know what's coming, to know what's going on. And somehow, if that is the case and that is accurate, which it might be because it's still an effective tool after all this time. So if it's based on the fact that not everyone can get their hands on it and it's not common knowledge and it's not even secret knowledge for people within the church, it's only specific people in the church that can access it, then that would mean that that's what's going on, that it has been hidden. It's been occulted so much that it's still effective, is basically what it says. So I find that interesting because I believe the same thing. So as much as I disagree with the church about almost absolutely everything, I will say that in this instance, I do not disagree with them. I'd say, yes, there are some things that you should not share. And I think that this is probably one of them because it's still effective. There hasn't been that many cases of true exorcism, though, in the Catholic Church. I believe it's 127 that have ever been actually marked as such. And that goes all the way back to the very first instance of demonic possession. And that was a long, long time ago. So I don't know how valid those actually are given today's standards. I don't know if they would still hold up as a true possession. But, you know, that's not that many for the amount of years that there has been of the church.
Yeah.
127 is not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because we're talking how many years now has the
over
church
centuries.
Been?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's like one a year, like less than one a year.
Yeah. Way less. If we're talking about, if we're going specifically from that manual, that's about 400 years or a little over 400 years, 450. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's low. And that's just a figure I found from some Catholic, it was a Catholic newsletter, and I don't know where it came from. So don't take that as gospel, but it's low. I know that it is low, and it seems to be ramping up lately, apparently. I'm not sure why.
Yeah. Well, I mean I think it's obvious.
What?
You know, well, people keep getting blown out by, there's a lot of occultism and people keep getting blown out by it because they're making the wrong decisions, you know, because they're engaging in demonolatry. I cannot tell you how many times I see that there is a difference between demon summoning and demonolatry, and I can't tell you how many times I see people in the entry levels recommending to other beginners to start treating these entities as your friend, or, you know, oh, you want them to be nicer to you, then, you know, just worship them and, you know, become friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 years down the line, they're hate God or hopeless alcoholic and getting like lives completely ruined and they're like, you know, why did this happen to me? You know,
there was a priestess that is a satanic priestess, and this is one of the more recent cases, and I believe it was the same one of the individuals that worked on the case that the exorcist was based off of was contacted by this person who reached out to them herself, and she had invited it in and then was like, uh-oh, I don't like this actually, and had to have an exorcism done. And that was one of the recent ones that was done, and there's an interview on YouTube about it. You can look it up.
Yeah.
And I think you just type in satanic priest, you know, priestess exorcism, it'll pop up. But she was instantly remorseful about it, instantly like, I shouldn't have done this. And so she was having moments of lucidity where she's normal, but then she was having episodes and fits. I have a curious like, I'm curious as to whether or not this is actually people believing something so much that it becomes real.
Yeah. That's like psychosomatic, yes. or something.
Yes. And yeah. There's a lot of the cases that are more recent where I think that that's probably what is going on, because of the fact that we have movie depictions of it and literature depictions of it. This is not the case back in the day. So I think those hold more weight for me. The ones that were not linked to another case, they you can't say that that person watched a movie where they saw a depiction of someone possessed.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I'm sure, it's talk about possession back then, because there was, in the Middle Ages especially, like when there was all the witch hunts and, you know, all of that stuff going on, everything was demonic, everything was heresy, I'm sure, back then. But before that and then after that, I'm saying it's less likely. It could have just been mental illness too, and we just didn't know what that was back then. Definitely, especially with schizophrenia and things like that, because that is the only mental illness that has persisted over time. All of the other ones are new, so to speak. And but schizophrenia is an actual illness, like an actual measurable, diagnosable illness, unlike all the other ones that are in psychology and psychiatry. So that makes sense to me too. But there are some accounts that I read in the historical record that I had to have either been exaggerated, or if they happened, then I would have to say that's not mental illness. You know, you can't levitate from mental illness, right? So unless they're making that up, you know, and that really happened, then that's concerning, you know. But there's a recent case, very recent case, and a new movie out about this case called Deliverance. Like, what was it?
I'm not sure what the movie was.
It's the Ammon case. And it was in Philadelphia, I think, recently. And this one was highly interesting to me, because when I heard about it, I heard that not only were the police witness to it, that the medical, emergency medical team at the hospital was witness to it, and the Child Protective Services social worker, all three groups of people witnessed this boy climbing backwards up a wall in the hospital on camera. Apparently there's footage of it somewhere, and Flip was on the ceiling there just somehow, and flipped down and stood right in front of one of the nurses and said some scary stuff to her. And this is documented, but there's a lot of contradictions in the story, and there's a lot of other people that were also there that deny or contradict some of it. So despite it allegedly being well documented and very recent, there's still the both camps. Ones that say it happened, ones that say it didn't. The exorcist that performed it said he had permission from the bishop, but there's questions about that, because now the church is saying that they did not give that permission, that he only had permission to do a minor rite and not the full one. And so there's a whole bunch of problems with it, and unfortunately. And then Zach Bagans from Ghost Adventurers ended up buying the house that the woman and her kids lived in and had it demolished. So there's no way to go and check in the house, you know. So there's evidence destroyed, all kinds of things like that. So I don't really know, but it is quite interesting. But I think most people are going to be familiar with this based on the movie The Exorcist, right? So what was that? Was that really true? Was that a real true story? Or was it just an adaptation?
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with it.
You're not?
No. Oh,
I know all about it. Okay. I know my enemies. Yeah. That movie scared the absolute shit out of me as a kid. So much so that I would have panic attack if I was scrolling through and just saw it as an option to watch. It would make me so scared. And I was so terrified of that idea. And when I was reading in that 1619 text earlier today about anxiety being a doorway in, I was like, oh my goodness. And I think I know why. Why do you think anxiety would be a doorway in?
Well, because it stirs you up, right? Like it's, you know, what we were talking about in the spiritual psychosis episode about occult madness or whatever. You make rash decisions and let things in when you're in a state of anxiety, frenzy,
oh,
that kind of thing, right?
I guess. I was thinking about my anxiety that I used to have, and I couldn't do anything. I was frozen. So I was trying to figure that out. But I guess if you're desperate, is it, do you mean like you're having anxiety, so you're desperately seeking a solution, so you'd be willing to ask for help
you just
somehow?
You just don't make the right decisions, right?
I guess, yeah.
So anxiety is a manifestation of a fight or flight response.
It is.
You know, generalized anxiety is basically a fight or flight response that can't get out, right? Yeah. And that is, you know, if we're going to go off the psychological partition model of spirits or whatever, having a background process like the fight or flight response running at all times, you know, that's going to create some kind of fracture. It's going to create some kind of manifestation.
I just saw that. So it makes your aura weak.
Mm.
It makes
it
crack.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's, you're always running on that fight or flight, like you said. And it takes away, it weakens your, I just saw it's like a slash in your field, I guess. So I think maybe that's accurate. I think, wasn't I told about something like that one time? About having a hole in my aura or something?
Yes, yeah.
And then it's not there anymore. That's nice.
It's not?
When I got according to the Sedona aura photography.
I thought I saw it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah. Because when we were in the hotel room, I was like, look, it's right where the spirit said it was. Yeah.
That's right, you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
I thought it was cool.
I got aura photography done in Sedona just for fun.
It was like some tourist trap thing.
Totally. But the lady actually.
But then she was legit. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it legit, like, as in she said stuff that I guess it could apply to other people. But, you know, she did mention that. And she did mention some things that I was like, what?
She gave you your aura reading, and it was stuff that we had learned a few months earlier in having a spirit diagnose what was going on with you or whatever.
Yeah.
We were starting an initiation, and what dictated how the initiation was going to go was what the spirit was telling us, like, this needs to be fixed, that kind of thing. And so then a few months later, we're out in the desert and you get the aura photography and we're just kind of like, okay, what is this? You know, like, this is dumb. And then the lady comes out and she starts talking about this, like, place in your aura. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, like, this
was weird.
Yeah, yeah. Very strange.
It was weird.
Yeah, but I was pleasantly surprised.
I was too. Yeah, it was a well-spent $30. It wasn't that bad. And giant report she printed out for me. I have pictures of it too. It's really cool. So the first person on the record was possessed in 1605. Their history was from 1605 to 1675. A young French woman, her name was Martha Brossier, somewhere in France, okay, thought to be possessed in 1618. Her case was one of the first scientific, quote unquote, exorcism trials under scrutiny by skeptics and medical observers. So this is the first person that had medical personnel evaluate her and say, you know, yeah, she's possessed. But there was people that disagreed with it even back then.
Yeah.
So interesting. That's interesting to me because I thought everyone was kind of on the bandwagon back then about burn the witch and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess not.
No, I don't think so. I think one of the interesting things about that book, though, the Exorcism Manual, as you were pointing, you said something earlier, but a lot of the diagnoses that they were giving for possession looked like epilepsy. They're saying that there would be convulsions, foaming at the mouth, and I was like, oh, well, here's the section that's about epileptics.
Yeah. It's like, so yeah, if there, that I did a short video series on TikTok a while back, about, and I called it shit people used to think was witchcraft, but it turned out to just be normal shit, you know, like, or something like that. And one of them was epilepsy. It's, if you had epilepsy or schizophrenia back then, you're screwed. Like, you're screwed. You're probably going to get an exorcism done on you, or not, or worse. So, and a lot of times back then, exorcisms ended in death. And even today, they still do. And that's one of the main reasons why you can't access this stuff, is because of the danger associated with it, according to the church. There's a danger for the participant, the afflicted, and a danger for all the people that are there to assist. So they don't specify what that danger is, other than acts of strength that are inhuman acts of strength and psychological trauma. So, and I, let me just say really quick, I had a friend back in the early 2000s in San Diego, and he wanted to be a priest so bad. He was a weirdo. And he went to Rome to become a priest, and we didn't see him for a long time. And then one night we were out at the club dancing, and we ran into him, and he did not look like himself anymore. He had gray hair, like maybe it was like more white, but he was young. I mean, we're in our early to mid 20s, and he did not look well. He looked very stressed out and tense. And so I went over to him. I'm like, hey, man, what's going on? How you been? Like, how's it going? And he's like, I can't. Like, it was bad. He had went to Rome, and he had got selected to do this, to do exorcisms. And he said he thought it was kind of a joke. Like, he didn't really believe it, despite his whole life, like, wanting to have this path. He said he really didn't put that much stock in it, but that I asked him if he'd seen something, and he said he didn't see anything. He heard it. And I guess there was audio tapes that they played, and whatever it was that he heard on that tape, and he didn't tell me what it was, literally changed his hair white or gray, and he left. Like, he left, he gave up, and he came back to the States. And was literally like not the same person at all. He was not he used to be, you know, fun and kind of, for someone that wants to be a priest, but, you know, a normal kind of person. And then he was this very just agitated, like, very, you know, looking around, like, paranoid person that was not the same person that we knew. And we all were like, whoa, what the heck? And we don't know what he saw or heard. Or he didn't see anything, he said, but he heard these recordings of some case, and it was so bad that he couldn't go back.
Yeah.
And he came home.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I can't really say anything more than that, but I experienced that encounter, and I was like, dang. And that, like, that was very eye-opening for me, because he seemed like a pretty rational person that turned into something else afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it I guess the danger is real. The struggle is real, I guess, so to speak. Yeah. Do you want to take a break?
No.
No? You want to just go through it?
We're going through
it. Power through it?
Yeah, we're powering through
it. For our exorcism, Halloween exorcism. Okay, yeah. So what do we got next?
So I think one of the things that I really liked about this was that there is the exorcism rite that is the invocation of the god names, right?
I knew that you would like that one. That's why I selected it to be printed out.
The invocation of the divine names, and the exorcist recites.
Yep.
Per tetragrammaton, Adonai, Elohim, Sabaoth, like Alpha et Omega. It's doing everything that I'm always saying on here, that the God names are incredibly important, but it's an invocation of all the attributes of God, and it's commanding the, you know, evil spirits to recognize the divine unity and, you know, leave. But I think, like, once again, we're seeing in this ritual, seeing this really important ceremonial magic procedure that, you know, this ritual is so much of what we do in ceremonial magic and occultism and ritual magic, and, you know, seeing the fingerprints all over it and then being able to trace it all the way back to Mesopotamia too is so, like, a testament to. So I think, like, one of my favorite mess ups we did was when we decided we were going to do an invocation without a magic circle to see if it was, like, we actually needed a magic circle. And it turned out we did actually need a magic circle. That is definitely one of those things. And what I see all over this Catholic exorcism, right, compared with, like, what we do in ceremonial magic, and then what I uncovered about the Mesopotamian exorcisms, I think this is a testament to, like, to me, this affirms, this is affirming for me, you know?
Anyways.
You know how when you say, like, oh, it was really important to me because it made me feel less crazy. Like, this right here makes me feel less crazy. This right here, seeing that it's, like, you know, the structure and the technique, and that it's tried and true, and that, you know, it works, and that even though the Catholic Church as an institution is against everything that Mesopotamia stands for and everything we stand for as magicians, but they're sitting here and they're like, no, these are the right techniques that you need to use if you're going to be dealing with this.
I saw that today. Yeah. I was going through that Latin document, and I had the table of contents translated first,
right? Yeah,
without the title. And I went through the chapters and I said, oh, I already, this one, Abamon, look, it's validating. He's going to be so excited. And I'm glad to know that I was right, because I know it does. And we have this conversation quite a bit, or at least I do. I found this out, and now I feel less crazy.
Yeah.
That comes out of my mouth so often. And now I'm glad to be hearing that from you. So it's I'm not alone.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel it now. And I think if we're going to compare it, though, these God names right here that they're using, these are attributes, something that I keep saying in all these episodes. The God names are attributes. You can almost think of them as, like, epithets of the One. And you go back to the Mesopotamian incantation, and right here, you could say, like, let's do a cross comparison. Tetragrammaton, Adonai, Elohim. It would be like Bel, Beltis, Ninib, like that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So Sabaoth, Ninib, mighty warrior of Bel, right there.
Mm-hmm.
Bel, Adonai.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost in the exact sequence, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I know. So, I was reading it and I was like, oh, this is the same. Yeah. Interesting.
It's crazy. So the God names are almost one to one the Mesopotamian deities that were being invoked in the Mesopotamian exorcism, right?
Yeah.
Which is...
So it does, it works. I mean, we know that it does, I guess. But, you know, this is not really something that I ever really want. You know, now that I've had these books, not this book that you had me look up today, but I have all of the other ones for a long time. And I had them just because, hoping I would never need them, you know, but turns out there's some instances in life where that would be necessary, I guess.
Yes, it is something that's necessary. There's actually a few people that teach exorcism in the occult and magic. And I was having a hard time finding one that I would recommend that people go learn from. However,
I don't know any.
Yeah. There's a certain lady that teaches exorcism, a certain lady that I have issue with. I'm not going to bring her up.
Yeah.
I cannot bring her name. I will not do it.
I mean, I never thought I'd encounter something like that in real life. And I was hoping I wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I did.
Yes. We did, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. That is your fault.
Yeah, because what happens with demonologists, you know, it's like it happens, and I'm telling you, oh man, it is so frustrating to me, so frustrating that people do this, you know,
Yes.
I mean, people make friends with their demons, their evil spirits, okay?
And then bring them to other people's
you
houses.
Make friends with them. Like, they're not your friend. They're not.
No, it's
I'm
like a
sorry.
Wild animal.
It's not.
It's like, oh, look at the lion over there. I'm going to go pet
yes,
it.
Exactly.
It's like, what are
it's
you talking
like,
about?
It's like you're the,
no,
you know.
Not even a lion. You're like the, a snake. Like some yeah. non, you know, one of the less, allegedly less sentient kind of creatures that has no, you can't reason with it. You can't, it's not. It
you're
has
the
like,
jackass Coke dealer with the pet orangutan that Rick.
Rips
your
face.
Dick off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's who you are when you make friends with demons, you know?
It's like, you, yeah, that's it's a like great
super
analogy.
Super cool until he flips out one day, rips your dick off. Yeah.
Or yeah. your face.
Or your
you
face.
Know, that
off.
Happened
yeah.
before they, what,
well,
the
no,
chimpanzee?
It, yeah. And it happens. And I'm saying this because it's frustrating because, like, literally today, I like went on this forum and I see somebody complaining about how they've been working with demons for 3 years and that, you know, their life's falling apart, they're really anxious, huh. that they're really paranoid and that kind of stuff, and then it just turns into a bunch of other beginners recommending them, well, instead of trying to bind them, why don't you make friends with them, you know? It's a lot easier when you worship them. And then, you know, they're more willing to do things for you. And it's like, no, because what happens then is now you've got this thing attached to you. And we experienced it.
We did.
Firsthand.
We.
Firsthand.
I cannot believe
yeah.
that happened. I really cannot. I still.
I.
You were here.
Yeah.
We were all together. Everyone. There was. It's not just me and Avamon. There were multiple people here. And it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I was proud of myself for how I handled it. Because based on my fear of it previously, I would have thought I would have absolutely
yeah,
lost
so,
it.
Yeah, so a demonologer was here having issues with their life and that kind of thing, wanted to know the name of the thing that was attached to them, and so I put them into hypnosis.
But it's
and
even
then,
creepier than that. Like how it went down. Like
yeah, yeah. Exactly. You know? To put them into hypnosis and then I tried to extract the name. And as I tried to extract the name, they start getting choked out, shaking violently.
Growling.
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 Yeah. And it was...
And it was... I was sitting over at my
well,
desk.
Yeah,
let's
I had
go.
To. Yeah, I had to hit. I had to hit the eject button because this was a demonologer, and
yeah.
And it's like, look, like, what am I gonna do?
Right.
I'm gonna exercise it, and then you're just gonna go give it booze yeah. tonight,
and
ask
it's gonna
it
be
for
in my house too.
Right? Yeah,
I mean, you
it's
know.
Like no.
I mean, I saw it. I physically saw it, and it was so just shocking. Like mm-hmm. it just popped up out of his shoulder.
Yeah.
And so, it was
there's
small.
There's no
that, oh my God, it was crazy.
So the difference between demon conjuring and demonolatry is where you make friends with or,
that's what that is.
Yeah, demonolatry is when you're friends, you have a copacetic relationship with the demon, right?
Is that possible?
You worship it as a deity or you treat it as your pal. It's not possible. Because you get a year, 2, 3 years down the line. You're fested. It destroys your life.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, worse things happen mm-hmm. than your life falling apart. Right. Whereas, like, demon conjuring, demon summoning, you are binding the thing. It is this, but you are commanding the demon to do stuff.
Why?
Right. So.
But why?
What do
why
you
even do it?
Oh, because it. I don't know. I'm just saying there's a difference. I'm not poo-pooing demon work in general. I think there is a practical utility for it in a Jobian sense. You know, I've definitely done it before. Then also, like, if you've never done magic before, I always recommend go summon demon, you know. You'll believe in magic real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because
that works. Solomonic, like, demon summoning, like, I think that's, it's like taking your first drug, you know. Mm. It's like
no.
it smacks you in the face. You're like, oh, wow, this is real. But demonolatry is the practice where it's like, oh, okay, well, now this is my buddy and I have an altar for it. Mm-hmm. And
it can come and
I
go
give it offerings and I have conversations with it all the time, that kind of stuff. And it's like, this thing is not your friend at all. And yeah. it, in any culture, it's not your friend. It doesn't matter. It's not just the Christians, you know, Mesopotamians didn't think that they were friends either.
No. And I will say,
Egyptians didn't think they were friends. Greeks didn't think they were friends.
Your friend, that entity could have easily jumped somewhere else.
Yeah. And so that's actually the thing. Something that does happen. That exorcism manuals were talking.
Oh,
were
talking I didn't see that. What did it say
about that? Yeah. So basically, you have to go. You have to go around and you have to pray or basically invoke on different body parts, on different people and different objects that are in the area, because you don't know if the demon hopped into something else, right?
Right.
And so you have to keep doing these checkups after you think that you've successfully driven it out. And you have to do it on the people that were present, the people that were assisting. Those people had to be pretty pious people as well. And then you also have to do any, like, let's say there's a chest in the area, like that kind of thing.
Objects, right? Because right. Yeah, yeah. They can inhabit things.
Yeah.
And that is, that was the intent of, I think that one was possibly not for me. Yeah. You know, but that was crazy. And so in that moment, you made the right decision because you shut it down and then they left. Right. But it's still there. And so I think it's important that you guys,
it's that person's decision to be there. It's one thing if you go to somebody and you're like, hey, I've got this thing attached to me and I need help get it. It's another thing if the thing attached to you that's ruining your life, you think is your friend. Like what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Like I can't do anything.
I could see the conflict in your friend. When I left the house that day, they were in front of the house sitting in the car and they didn't ring the doorbell for over 30 minutes because I got the notification on my phone. They were outside talking about whether or not they were going to come in because he came here to get help, but didn't even tell you that.
No,
didn't tell
know.
You.
Yeah.
I had till no I idea. Came home and then he told me, and it was like I could see this playing out where it was like half him trying to get help and then half not him refusing help. Like, it was very weird. It was like split identity almost. Mm-hmm. And then tricks, you know. So if you know somebody that does this kind of work or has these ideas that these things can be their friend, yeah, you need to be careful around those people, because
yeah,
I'm serious, because at the end of that session, it tried to trick us to accept it.
Yeah.
And it almost worked, but luckily it didn't. And, you know, it was crafty. It appealed to both of our desire to understand and to crack codes and yeah, to learn secret. It was really underhanded.
He went into auto writing, mm-hmm, after pulled him out of the session. He went into auto writing. He wrote something and he said, this is for you. And he handed it to you. Mm-hmm. You grabbed it, and I looked at it, and I took it and immediately gave it back to him. I was like, this is yours.
Yeah.
Like,
he wanted to hand it because it was the name in a code.
Yeah, it was the name in a code.
And he said, you need to decode this, and there's the name of this thing. And I'm like, I don't want this. Here you go. Like, no way. Because I knew in that moment, oh, putting any effort into this would be opening that door. It's like opening the door can look very, mm-hmm, not like opening a door.
Just having, I mean, a general rule of thumb, don't accept anything from other magicians, right?
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Is that a rule?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean? Like nothing?
If a magician gives you a gift, don't accept it.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
But no one's ever given me, no magician, I don't know.
You've
any.
Given me plenty of gifts. I fully accepted that.
I'm not doing anything to you.
You have captured me. I'm now her prisoner. Okay. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. That was mean.
You are free to do your thing, except for the fact that, you know, we're married.
Yeah.
Not you're my prisoner. Jesus. You make it sound like I'm some, like, taskmaster over here. No, I'm not. That's right. That's right. You say, I'm just kidding. No, he's totally my prisoner and I am keeping him. Yes. Yeah, you're mine. So the thing is that you have to be careful about this stuff. It seems interesting. It seems fun. Maybe enticing power associated with it, reward, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, the price, I think, is far greater than what you would get out of it.
Yeah. Well, there's only so much practical magic can do for you, right? And so it's like when you first start working with demons, like the first couple years, it's like the first year, first 2 years, it's awesome because you're making stuff happen. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is crazy, right? Mm-hmm. But you start isolating, you start becoming antisocial, aggressive, mm-hmm. anxious, paranoid, delusional. And then once it starts getting really bad, that's when people start committing crimes, they start hurting themselves, they start hurting others.
So that's oppression, infestation, right? So we move that when they start doing the actions, that's the infestation phase, right? Then it's possession after that. And, the one question I have, though, I do have this question, and maybe you know the answer, maybe not. Maybe someone else does. Why is it that all of the cases that are reported are people that are religious? Minus the satanic priestess chick.
What do you mean?
All the other people are Catholic or Christian.
So this is something that drives me nuts about Christian theology or the way that they teach Christians to view demons. I think this happens more with American Christians than it does with East Orthodox or Catholics in general. But Christians are taught to fear demons and that demons are everywhere. And there's something to be scared of, right? Now, what we know about that exorcism rite is that the church itself says, do not get this confused. The ritual is not what has power. Not the relic. It is your unshakable faith in God. That is what provides this ritual power. This is what helps the afflicted. And if you are going to help somebody that is afflicted with demons, you have to have unshakable faith in God. So the idea that these demons are more powerful, and this is something that I've learned in my personal experience in dealing with demons, or not dealing with it, but just spirits in general. My best defense against anything, against black magic, against demons, against wizard battles, is faith. Is faith every single time. Acceptance and faith. I just accept what's coming at me, have faith that, is for a purpose and everything works out.
True.
Everything's fine. So I think what happens with Christians is because they're taught that these things are more powerful than them, and when you have fear, when you have anxiety, you subjugate yourself to spirits. You're basically telling them that you have power over me. I am scared of you, right? You have power over me, right? It's like let's say you've got a mean teacher, like you're in middle school. You're 12 years old. You're in middle school and you're scared of your teacher. And then you hit that moment in every middle schooler's life where they realize, oh, you can't do shit. And then you take over the classroom, right? And he's like, oh, wait, you actually, why am I scared of you?
Damn it.
You can't touch me.
Darn it. I liked those days when the kids were scared of me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of the same thing with spirits, right? This fear that you have over this thing that doesn't have a physical body.
Right.
Right? Doesn't have a physical body. It doesn't have a divine spark in it. Doesn't have the soul. Thing that connects you to everything,
right?
And you're scared of it.
Yeah.
Why are you scared of it? And so with these Christians that are taught to fear these things, then they get confronted with one and they subjugate themselves to it through fear, through anxiety, right?
Yeah.
The more you are scared of these things,
the more
power they have to you. And then so that's why you see lapsed religious people might get infested with them more than somebody who has faith, you know?
Right. I mean, that's the thing is, and then I think this works across the board with any kind of entity or spirit, because I know, I admit, I am startled when things like that happen, any kind of paranormal activity happens, I'm startled. But, and my life was riddled with it for many, many decades, for, you know, my entire life until very recently. And the thing that changed was that it was being told and shown through that experience I had with that neighbor, Guatemalan lady, that I could control, I had control over it. And if I was, you know, letting myself be afflicted by it, I was letting myself be afflicted by it, or I could not, and I could assert myself and my authority and my dominance, right? So I did that, and then it stopped. Just stopped. So I believe that. I know that Christians are definitely taught to fear them. And, you know, then we have movies and books and things and pop culture that reinforce that belief. And they are unpleasant and they are scary, but, you know, so are spiders. Spiders are scary too. But are they, you're going to let it lit, you know, what are you going to do about it? Or roaches or something gross, you know, some bugs are terrifying. I mean, I surely don't like them, but I'm definitely going to kill it. You know, like it's not going to survive because I refuse to let it be in my presence, right? It's the same kind of vibe. You have to know that your authority and your agency is what matters, and you have to believe in it. Just like, and the whole thing about the tools and or the words not mattering or they not having the power, same in witchcraft, same exact thing. Like I say all the time, your wand doesn't have power, your tarot cards don't have power, your incense, your whatever it is, doesn't have power. It's you. And it's your belief in what you're doing that matters, right? And that is what, you know, Dr. Radin says too in his research, is that it's the belief that matters. So people that don't believe it, you know, they don't have this problem. We don't have any, there's no case here that I could find of somebody that didn't believe in it that was possessed. You know what I mean? So there's that too. So that psychosomatic, no, I'm not sure. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. But it is interesting. And I don't know that we'll ever really have the answer. It's not like they can see possession on an MRI or a CAT scan, you know, or blood test. So I don't really know how we'll ever prove it. But, you know, there's definitely some weird stuff afoot out there. And especially at this time of year when the veil's thinner for whatever reason.
Yeah.
You know, why is that?
It's a great time of year, actually.
I love it. It's my favorite.
I got something great. So by the time this episode airs,
yes,
we will have conducted our first hermetic occult mass service thing, right?
All right.
So if you are listening or watching, go check it out on the YouTube channel.
Yes.
Because we are going to be talking about why this stuff happens this year, because the planets are screaming it.
Oh,
right?
Are they?
And
are they?
On our Sunday service live stream, we talk about the astrological forecast for this week,
mm-hmm.
and how the sun is entering Scorpio,
yeah.
and Mercury and Mars are hitting a conjunction and are trine with Saturn. And there's actually a great story from our esoteric and occult lineage. There's the story of Isis and Osiris,
oh.
and specifically when Typhon dismembers Osiris. And this is actually what the planets are playing out right now at this moment.
Oh, really?
As the sun enters into Scorpio. Scorpio is the domicile of Mars. Mars is Typhon, is Seth, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mercury, who's Hermes, comes in conjunction with Mars. And what happens in this specific moment is that Mercury acts as the lawyer in this moment that basically proves Horus's legitimacy as Typhon is trying to besmirch Horus.
Hmm.
Typhon is the child of Cronus of Saturn, right?
Okay.
So the planets themselves are telling us about Osiris's death right now. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And, well, his resurrection hasn't happened yet, but the planets are playing out this mythological drama at this moment right now in the sky.
Is it a three-day long resurrection?
And actually, you want to know when this happened? When this happened?
When?
It happened on the 17th day of October.
That's today.
Yeah.
That's today. Well,
that's what it happens in the story. Isn't that crazy that all the planets are doing this at that moment?
I wonder why that is. Is it, you know, interesting? I know none of this stuff. This is all new. And on Sunday morning, it's
esoteric.
It.
That's esoteric, baby.
Yes,
that's
it is. Just, I learned so much.
That's how it works.
Every day.
My eyes were opened. I couldn't believe it when I saw what the planets were doing. And then I was like, wait a minute. They're literally reenacting this drama right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. So
I love our life.
Check out the Esoteric Occult Service to learn more about what this means for you.
Yeah. Make sure you set your notifications to let you know when we're on live.
Yeah. Yeah. Set your notifications and make sure you subscribe now. We got a lot of stuff that's going on this channel. Very, very excited about what's going on moving forward. Right? Yeah.
And we really appreciate everybody's comments and support. And I love interacting with you guys in the comments. And we try our best to get all of, you know, respond to every comment that we can, provided it's not some nonsense. But, you know, we really appreciate it very much. And I hope that we see you guys on Sunday.
Yeah, I hope to see you guys on Sundays at the service. And if you miss it, it's great, though, to be able to interact with us and, you know, tell us about what's going on. Hopefully get some wizardly or oracle insight.
I don't read oracle cards, but yeah, you know, I don't do oracle cards. But
sorry, I say oracle as in like the Oracle of Delphi.
And I hear oracle and I think of those cards, but
no, I'm gonna get you drugged up on like, you know, I'm gonna get you huffing gasoline and just like zoning out, like, you know,
like methane from the volcanic underground. Yeah, that's what it was, right? Something like that.
Yeah, there's like a gas leak in there.
Yeah, yeah, they're just. Carbon monoxide poisoning over here.
I was talking to somebody the other night about how Steve-O, you know, from Jackass, he would get crazy hallucinations because of the amount of drugs he was huffing, and he was killing off the oxygen to his brain so much that he was hallucinating.
Damn.
So maybe that was what was happening with the Oracle.
Probably. I'm not sure, but
she wasn't getting oxygen because she was just Pythia. Huffing. Yeah.
It was like, you guys, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
Somebody give me some
fresh
air. That's
where her visions were coming from.
It's the death of the brain cells. Yeah. Every time they die, they left off a little spark, and there was a little image there for her, I guess. Yeah. Well, we won't be doing that. I will not be engaging in that. But I will be reading cards or whatever I do. I don't really know. And yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be the first time, you know, well, you guys will already have missed it by then, or you joined it. We don't know, but it'll be every week. So check it out if you didn't make it this week. Okay.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Discourse, where we venture into the mysteries of esotericism, the occult, and the depths of spiritual exploration. I am Abimon the Great, joined as always by Dr. Anna Stone, bringing adept insights to help guide your journey. Remember, the path of wisdom is illuminated by both knowledge and experience. Until next time, continue your exploration and stay attuned to the unseen.